This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Crayon. Okay, probably none of us have ever been schooled at Hogwarts, but this is the season for something more magical than any of Harry Potter's friends ever performed with a wand. When you think of it, it really is kind of miraculous. You take a tiny seed, or seedling, plant it in some earth, give it sunshine, water, and a bit of attention, and before too long, out pops vegetable or fruit, ready to fill you with delicious nourishment. Although it isn't always that simple. Like any magic, there are pesky problems to watch out for, and sometimes those challenges are more than you know how to handle all on your own. Not to worry, our expert green thumb wizards are back. Gardening advisors Guinevere Higgins and Dave O'Neill here to take any question your garden has ever raised. And if you've got hard-won gardening lessons of your own to share, we'd love to hear those too, right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Gardening is our focus this hour. 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. And if you have ever tuned in before when Green Thumb advisors Guinevere and David were here, you probably recall that we tend to run out of time before we can get to all the people who phone in during the last few minutes of a broadcast. So if you'd be willing to get your call in early, that would be a really good thing. Whether you're dealing with pesky critters, small or large, too much sun, too much shade, concerns about soil quality, cucumbers that just won't cooperate, or any other kind of gardening concern with which you could use some help, 888-967-2825. From the Radical Roots Community Farm in Keezeltown, which he co-owns, Dave O'Neill, and from the Charlottesville-based garden consulting firm Blue Ridge Backyard Harvest, which she co-founded, Guinevere Higgins, great to see you both again.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks for having us back.
Weather?
Weather is hot, hot. That's the main theme for this March. We're, you know, our soil temperatures specifically are way warmer than normal, and we see all kinds of bloom in progress. We see forsythias blooming right with dogwoods, which are usually staggered by a month apart. And so how does that affect our garden? Well, there's lots of temptation to get started early, but that last frost is still, you know, the average last frost date is 6 weeks away. So basically, we want to strategize and design our gardens to be more resilient to these weather impacts. And I have a lot of ideas for our listeners on how to do that. Don't be afraid to start early, but keep an eye on the weather. Keep crop protection in mind. For tonight, example, it might frost. I don't know how many people have already planted tender things outside, but they're going to need to be protected tonight.
Tender things.
Tender things, any of our tender garden crops like basil or tomatoes or cucumbers or squash, they grow great in the summertime around here because they love the warmth, and it's a lot of people are excited about them and like to start them early. But when the temperature drops below 32 degrees, they're not gonna do well. The cell walls are gonna freeze and burst, so they need to be covered and protected.
But there's plenty of things you can be planting right now that are perfectly cold hardy, even when it gets below freezing, even if you don't have crop protection in place. And those are things like lettuce and beets, carrots, kale, spinach, Swiss chard, peas, onions, potatoes. There's a lot. There's a lot you can get started right now and be free from worry as far as how far the temperatures go.
Tell me more about protection, if you would, Guinevere.
Well, there's some simple and easy frost protection measures you can take. A great strategy is using row cover, which is a spun polyester fabric. It's very lightweight, and it allows light and air and water to penetrate into the soil and onto the plant. So, but it, you know, depending on how heavy it is, it can provide anywhere from maybe 2 to 6 degrees of temperature protection, which, you know, on a night potentially like tonight might make the difference between healthy, happy plants and very unhappy and unhappy plants.
And crop protection strategies work on any kind of scale, because on our farm, Radical Roots Farm, we have tomato plants that are already 24 inches tall with flowers and fruit on them. And, you know, last year was a cold March, and we got those tomato plants through a 24-degree night. How did we do that? Well, it was no magic and no wizardry. Simply We used a black plastic on the bed, which helped warm up the soil early. We used that spunbound polyester row cover over the plant itself. And then this was planted in a high tunnel, which is a single layer plastic greenhouse structure. So that added up 8 degrees of crop protection. And there's small scale strategies that are very similar to the field scale. In the backyard, you can use a simple cold frame, which is basically a wooden box with a piece of glass or plastic on top of it. And that can help with a few degrees of crop protection as well.
Yeah, and I would also add that, you know, because we've had such an unusually warm March, I've seen a lot of people using their row covers over the last few weeks. And you have to be a little careful because when it does get to be 80 or 85 degrees, it's actually getting really, really hot under that row cover for your poor plants. So, you know, it's important to, whether you've got row cover or maybe you're using a cold frame like Dave suggests, you also want to think about ventilation and making sure that you're giving those plants some fresh air too, because they actually, you know, the stuff that wants to go out early, it doesn't want to get too hot.
Environmentalist and professional gardener Guinevere Higgins, as well as environmentalist and professional farmer Dave O'Neill, are our guests. Our call-in number, 888-967-2825. All the phone lines open at the moment, and you can remember that number fairly easily as 888-WMRA-TALK. Most of me is recovered, Dave and Guinevere, except my voice. So I printed out the Facebook questions that came in before the show. You want to?
Sure. Steven says, how and when to organically stop those nasty bugs from biting my plums and peaches? Then they rot and mold, with a sour face on the type. Organic fruit is the last frontier. It's very challenging here in the East when we do have a lot of pest and disease pressure. So we need to expect that. We know it's going to be tricky. There's a lot of strategies that we can employ. First and foremost is planting diversity. And by that, I mean planting a lot of different companion species that are going to support that fruit and those flowers of those fruits. So we need lots of perennial bloom in the garden, because if we want to invite If we want to deter pests in the garden, we need pest predators. And the way we invite those into the garden is to have nectar and bloom all through the season. So starting right now with daffodils and going all the way through September and October with late bloomers, we want perennial bloomers in the garden.
So, give me an example of a predator and a predatee.
Well, there's all sorts of different predators that are going to attack our fruit trees. Everything from, you know, scab to mildews to...
But I think what you meant is that there are certain insects that you can attract into your garden who will snatch up the bad pests.
Exactly. We want habitat for ladybugs. We want goldfinches. We want all these beneficial insects in there as well.
A great example is there's a wonderful parasitic wasp that lays eggs in tomato hornworms. We want those wasps in our gardens, and it saves us the trouble of having to find those notoriously camouflaged hornworms, and the wasps will find them and take care of them for us, and it's really handy. They do a lot of great work for us.
Sally and Swope, you're our first call. Thanks for being that person, and we now want to hear what you have to say about gardening. Or a question for Dave and Guinevere.
Okay. Now?
Now.
Okay. Hello.
Hello.
This is
Hi.
Sally in Swope. And I've had a wisteria I planted 6 years ago against my house. It's in full sun and it's never bloomed. I've done everything I'm supposed to do. I crop it right back. But and I haven't put any fertilizer on it because I know that they don't like fertilizer. But it's never bloomed. Can you help?
I'm not sure about that one. Wisteria is usually very prolific.
Yeah, usually not hard to get it to bloom.
And cutting it back would be good for it to stimulate growth and bud and bloom.
Right. Well, somebody told me that I should have got a female wisteria, but I mean, is that correct? I don't know.
I mean, that's the only thing that would come to mind as far as why a plant would just simply never, ever bloom, because it just doesn't have those parts. But
I get tons of green, you know, lots of green. I mean, it's very pretty. But, of course, there's none of those gorgeous blossoms that hang down, you know.
Yeah, and
we've just never had them.
There are different kinds of wisteria by gender?
Yes.
A lot of plants are dioecious, meaning there's male flowers and there's female flowers. And a good example in the fruit world is kiwi, hardy kiwi that grows here and it's hardy here. And the only way to get it to fruit is if you have male flowers blooming at the same time of the female flowers, and they cross, you know, pollinate basically, and the pollen from the male fertilizes the female flower.
Do you think that's my problem with my wisteria, or?
It's possible. I don't know enough about wisteria to know if that is okay. A problem you could be having, but
all right, okay. Well, is anyway, it something thank you. That you... I just wondered if there was something I wasn't doing correctly, but
Sally, hold on just a second. Is it something, Guinevere, that with all of your knowledge about where to look for information, you might be able to find out, or you, Dave, and then we could post it on our website or our Facebook page for Sally to see?
I mean, you can't go wrong with consulting Michael Durr. He is sort of the expert on woody plants.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got, you know, the manual of woody plants, and then he has a guide to trees and shrubs that I use a lot.
Okay.
You know, and I believe he has a Facebook and an iPad app. Or excuse me, an iPhone and iPad app. So you might look to Durr for some good advice.
Okay. Well, thank you anyway.
Thank you so
thank
much for
you.
Calling,
good luck.
Sally.
Have a lovely day. It's
thank
so
you.
Gorgeous, the weather. Bye.
Until it freezes tonight.
Yes.
We'll see.
Is there a way when you're planting wisteria that you can tell that you've got a male plant or a female plant?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
In my example with the hardy kiwis, you have to take cuttings from a known source and basically permanently tag them. We use copper metal tags that are really permanent. And, you know, the leaf shape looks subtly different. And if you line them up with an existing male, you can kind of tell. But it's very hard once they're separate from the parent plant to really, really track those.
Well, to you who are listening, you may have noticed, if you listen to this show ever, that I talk too much. I know I talk too much. I'm talking too much right now. But what makes this even more annoying today is that my talking too much will also lead to my coughing too much. So if you're willing to do you and everyone listening a favor, make me talk less by calling in and taking up some talk time yourself with any comment or question that is gardening related. We are at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Here with me, gardening advisors Dave O'Neill and Guinevere Higgins. Guinevere, I understand Bill here on this list of Facebook questions has one that's not your favorite, but the advantage of you reading the question is that we can then have Dave address the question.
Great.
This is a question I actually get quite often, and I think it's because I'm oftentimes in conversation with folks who are gardening in town, in urban environments, and this tends to be a problem. Bill asks, my neighbor's cats like to use my raised veggie beds as a litter box. Short of spending the money on a fence, what's the most effective way to keep them at bay? And I'll happily turn that over to Dave.
Bill, it's such a hard question because, you know, it points at, oh, I have a pest. What is a pest in the garden? It's any species that you don't want in there. And on our farm, pests range in size from a flea beetle, which is a small beetle about the size of the head of a pin, which eats any of your broccoli family crops, all the way up to a deer, you know, a 200-pound buck. And how do we deal with pests? Well, we don't want them in our garden. So one of the best strategies is to exclude them from our garden.
Yes.
Whatever pest it is.
A physical barrier.
The neighbor's cat, yeah. So there's lots of different exclusion strategies. On our farm, we have an 8-foot-tall deer fence to keep the deer out of the farm. And then we also use the floating row cover, which is the spunbound polyester fabric. And that keeps them off the actual bed. So if you already have raised beds, you know, with wooden sides, why not do small fences there?
Mm-hmm.
Or
get
a dog. That always works.
So right now, if you're calling 888-967-2825, you're getting a busy signal because all of a sudden, all our lines are taken. But we're going to get to some of those calls and open up some lines in just a bit more than 1 minute. organic gardening advisor and operator of Radical Roots Community Farm in Keezletown, Dave O'Neill, is one of our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight. Sitting next to him, another organic gardening specialist, Guinevere Higgins. She runs Blue Ridge Backyard Harvest, a gardening consulting firm based in Charlottesville. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and I'm pretty sure this fellow from Crozet goes by the name Peter. Peter, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Hi. I know from past experience that the deer will happily browse my garden. And I do have long-term plans of getting up some deer fence. But in the meantime, what can I plant that they don't like to eat?
Are you thinking, Peter, about edible plantings or ornamental plantings?
Edible garden type, food garden.
Food garden types. Well, unfortunately, I don't know of too many options. If the plans for a deer fence are going to come to fruition in short order or, sometime this season, you might be able to get away with starting stuff. Again, using that floating row cover is a great deterrent.
Uh-huh.
You can also sometimes, you might have old sheets of fencing lying around. I've used that as a strategy before, welded wire fencing 4 or 5 feet tall. If you cut a length of that and then sort of bend it, it can cover the crops just enough so that deer can't, get in and munch them. I'm also a huge fan, if you are considering a deer fence, I'm a huge fan of Premier One Electra netting. And it's used often for pastured poultry operations.
Uh-huh.
But I've used it with clients and their vegetable gardens. It's incredibly effective against all manner of large four-legged pests. And that electric fencing really is just, it's awesome. It's solar powered. It's relatively inexpensive compared to constructing a nice looking permanent fence. And the nice thing about it too is you can take it down, you can reconfigure it, you can make it bigger. So I would recommend that as a strategy for thinking about keeping up, pests like deer and groundhog and rabbits and all kinds of pests like that. And even the 4-foot high deer fence works when it's electrified.
That's Premier One.
Premier One Fencing.
Very good.
I promise I'm not taking any money from them. I just like what they do.
Wow.
David O'Neill, can you think of anything that Peter might like to eat growing out of the ground that the deer would not like to eat?
I mean, if it's good for you and I, it's good for the deer too. That's just the general rule. They have
So they'll eat Brussels sprouts.
They will.
Oh, yeah.
Anything tender and juicy, they will munch on. But if we think like a deer, we realize that deer don't like small spaces. So if we're not ready to deer fence the whole big backyard, we could just put even a short fence, even a 3-foot fence around a 4x10 garden is going to keep them out. So small spaced protection is sometimes effective if we're not ready to do the whole backyard.
Okay.
Peter, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
It's another situation where a dog could come in handy as well.
888-967-2825. Easy to remember is 888-WMRA-TALK. If you have a question, a quandary, or a suggestion to offer about gardening, Fran, we understand you're pulled over safely off of a highway someplace, and you actually have some information for a previous caller?
Yes, my fellow English lady, who I don't
Sally.
Know. Yes, but I have a wisteria. Actually, I have two, and I don't know if that made the difference. But it took 6 years for mine to bloom.
Okay, so it was mature enough to want to go into the reproductive stage.
Yeah, I mean, last year I got like 3, and this year it's going to be absolutely spectacular. And my only thing is just be patient, it'll happen.
Ah, good to know.
Mm-hmm.
Fran, if it's not too personal a question, can you tell us where your home is, what community you're in?
Oh, I live down in Scottsville.
Okay.
Oh, great.
Wouldn't be any difference in your mind, Dave or Guinevere, in growing wisteria in Scottsville versus Swope, where Sally was from?
Yeah, they might be one USDA hardiness zone cooler in Swope, a 7 in Scottsville and a zone 6 in Swope. But still, wisteria is hardy to either zone and should be blooming beautifully in both.
Fran, thanks so much for calling and giving all of us wisteria lovers hope.
Okay, great show. Thank you, guys.
Next, we're going to Free Union. Erica has joined us. Your question or comment for Dave O'Neill and Guinevere Higgins. Please, Erica.
Hi. Hi, how's it going, guys? It's Erica from Pre-Union Grass Farm.
Erica, I'm wearing your T-shirt.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, we have lots of experience raising meat at the grass farm, but Joel and I are just kind of just figuring out how to raise vegetables. And so we did a lot of work getting a bunch of raised beds ready this year in our garden. But as the warmer temperatures have come, so has a bunch of vetch, and we've got a ton of wire grass that's just been there for a long time. So we're trying to figure out a way that we could maybe in a natural or somewhat organic way try to fight that. Do you guys have any like soil remedy ideas other than just like manual removal?
Okay, before you respond to Erica, I have to ask, because she used a word that sounded like, some of my Jewish friends would use in making jokes about each other. Was it vetch?
Vetch.
What is a vetch?
Vetch, V-E-T-C-H. It's a legume, I believe, and it's just really pervasive. There's a bunch of root material that you can't even really see in the wintertime when we turned the beds. We didn't even really know where it was. The wire grass is a lot easier to spot, but it just takes over. It's got a bunch of little leaves all over it. And I don't know. Go ahead, guys.
Both tricky plants to deal with. Vetch is sometimes an ingredient in cover crop mixes because it is a legume, which means it fixes nitrogen in the soil, which is a good thing because nitrogen is the key ingredient for green, lush plant growth. All plants need it. To grow strong. So the vetch, even though it's really pervasive, it pulls out easier, and it's not probably as much of a problem. Wiregrass, on the other hand, I can imagine is going to be a mess.
Yeah.
And what do you do with your tender, tomato plants and wiregrass? They don't get along.
Mm-hmm.
So one strategy is to start with some really kind of thorough bed prep and trying to thin it out by hand.
And now is the best time to do it because it's only going to get harder, unfortunately.
And then going in with very deep mulching, like sheet mulching, which is defined by many layers. The first layer would be the sheet layer using cardboard or newspaper, thick multiple layers of cardboard, and then compost and straw mulch or leaf mulch on top of that. That will suppress it. And you can poke through that and get your tomato transplants and your lettuce plugs and all that planted. So thinking ahead, thinking about the weeds and kind of working with them with pulling them out ahead of time and then sheet mulching deeply.
Okay, cool. We heard once that you could, I think Joel's dad thought of this years ago, which is that you could put calcium, like you could lime the soil too. Does that help with the wiregrass at all? Or is that just, superfluous?
That's a good question. I mean, keeping in mind that lime is going to elevate your pH.
Mm-hmm.
So, there are going to be sort of other factors that go along with using lime. I've not heard that, but could be an interesting experiment. Maybe you'd want to try in one bed.
Yeah, since we're not production veggie farmers, maybe we'll try it out and let you guys know.
That would be great.
You're the professionals.
There you go.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Erica.
Erica, and there's a good chance that they're going to be back here again in a couple of months. So
if
you've completed your experiment by then,
I'll follow up.
Please do
let us know.
Awesome. Good to talk to you guys.
Yeah,
have
see you at
one.
Market.
Organic gardening specialist David O'Neill is co-owner of the Radical Roots Farm in Keezletown. Actually, its full name, Radical Roots Community Farm. Organic gardening specialist Guinevere Higgins is co-owner of the Charlottesville-based garden consulting firm called Blue Ridge Backyard Harvest. If you want to talk to them, we now do have two lines. All of a sudden, they're open. So if you've been trying and you've been getting a busy signal, this would be a good time to try again at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Richmond is where we go next, the community of, to talk with someone named Quentin, I believe. Quentin, your question or comment, please.
Yeah, I have a just kind of a backyard area by the side of my house that I'm tearing just miscellaneous old plants out, and I want to plant with vegetables. There's a pretty big stump from some kind of shrub there, and as I was just playing in the dirt, I noticed it looks like some bees are moving into that stump right in the midst of where I thought I'd put my vegetables. I don't know too much about bees, but I could imagine they would have the good pollinating potential and that kind of thing. I wondered whether I should let them be and just work around them or maybe try to get them out of there. That's my question. I guess I'll take my answer off the air.
Oh, Quentin, hang on, just in case our guests have any questions for you. But okay, the basic, sure. Should
the first
let,
question
let
is:
the bees be?
Is are they honeybees? Can you tell?
Yeah,
can
do you know what they are?
They're small, about the size of I don't know, maybe your pinky knuckle. They look like honeybees. They're not the big bumblebees. I don't know how many bee varieties we have.
I mean, you could just be very lucky and have your very own beehive that's just decided to adopt you. I know if you are trying to get sort of eliminate the, you know, because maybe you don't want to get stung by bees, or you want to go ahead and put your garden in and not worry about the bees. There are beekeeping organizations that will come and try to harvest your bees for you to capture your swarm and locate them either in someone's hive or relocate them in a place where they can be productive bee honeymakers.
It's unimaginable to me that we'd have a swarm this early because it's usually an April-May thing again. But if they got through the winter okay and they had already built up some stores and run out of room, maybe they did swarm. You know, a new queen, the old queen would take half the colony and move, and that's how bees reproduce in nature. You probably don't want them getting established in your stump. Whether you're up for moving them, when they are swarming, they're very docile. They're not defensive. They don't have anything to defend yet. So oftentimes beekeepers can move them without any protective clothing or smoke. They can just basically pick them up, put them in a box, and move them. You know, I can't imagine the stump is the most ideal place for them, although sometimes they'll just be there for 24 to 48 hours while scout bees are, moving all over the area looking for a permanent home. So maybe they'll, be gone in 2 days and you can get that stump out of there and get your veggies growing. But if they're not gone in 2 days, I would contact one of the local beekeeping organizations and ask if someone can come and move them. And before
so for
you do
Quentin
that,
in Richmond or anybody else listening anywhere in our region who might have a similar issue, how do you go about finding one of these beekeeping organizations?
I know the Shenandoah Valley Beekeeping Association is really active. They have a monthly meeting and they're on Facebook all the time. They have a website.
So you can just type in Beekeeping Association in an internet search and hope that something comes up in your area?
Yeah. And they have a hotline where they have a list of active beekeepers who will move swarms. Often the fire station will have the same copy of that list of active beekeepers who will move swarms.
And the Central Virginia Beekeepers Association on the other side of the Blue Ridge might be a good option for Quentin. And again, they have offer the same services that Dave just described.
Quentin, because of you, I've learned so much more about bees than I ever knew. Thank you. Hope
yeah,
it helped.
Thank you all very much.
Sure.
And I'll just add, since we're talking about bees, I know the local food hub down in Scottsville is offering a home scale beekeeping course with Central Virginia Beekeepers Association. I believe it's early May or late April.
I think it's April 1st.
Oh, maybe it's April 1st.
I think it's
coming right up
this Sunday.
Oh, well, so, hop on over to their website if you're interested and see if there's any room left, because I'm sure it would be worthwhile. It's the local food hub. Check them out.
Next to Afton Wynn, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment for gardening advisors Guinevere Higgins and or Dave O'Neill, please.
Hi, Guinevere. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm really enjoying your show. I am an avid horticulturist. I have a highly landscaped yard. I don't grow vegetables, but living on the top of Afton Mountain, I'm right in the middle of the George Washington National Forest, and a deer is present up here, as are birds and fleas. It's absolutely amazing the herds of deer we have, and yet I have absolutely no damage to. I probably have 75 or 80 varieties of hostas and 25 varieties of roses, and both of them are just candy to deer. And I've lived up here about 20 years and never found a product, either a home remedy or a product that would work to keep them away, until I finally came upon a product called Bobex, B-O-B-B-E-X. And I got this over at the Etz farm, and I'm not trying to punch up their name It's just that that is the only place I know in this area that has it. And I suggested to several friends that they try it, and they said they didn't like it. Mm. And the problem that people have with it, one is it's initially expensive, and two, that they use way, way too much. I put down the lightest of mists. I mean, it is just, I say, put it on as if a lady would squirt a squirt of perfume in the air and walk through it. And an extremely light mist. I have, for instance, a fence that's 160 feet long with climbing roses all over it. And I have pictures of the deer actually grazing on my yard next to those roses and not touching them.
Wow.
I have,
have you sent that to Bob X?
Bob X, B-O-B-B-E-X.
I think they'd like to have that picture.
Yeah, and I strongly recommend it. I have tried, honestly tried over 20 years, 25 or 30 different products and or home remedies. And this, as long as you don't use too much of it, it just takes the very lightest of mist, and I only use it 3 or 4 times a summer.
Wow.
I got to ask,
zero
what,
damage.
What do you hear from other people who did use too much of it? What is it that happens when they use too much of it?
When they use too much of it, it stinks.
I think so.
That's the part that you forgot to mention, Wynn.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
that's why it works.
Yeah.
But the point is, if you put on a very, very light mist of it, it doesn't. It will smell when you put it on, but within an hour, the smell is gone. But you have to remember the sensitivity of smell in deer is probably 500 times what the sensitivity is in a human. And
when, again, you know, we're not commercial radio, we're not advertising any particular group, but since you're talking about something that lots of people are going to be interested in, spell the name of the product you're using, if you would, please.
Yeah, sure. B-O-B-B-E-X. I'm sure you can look it up online. And the only place I know in the area, and I'm not trying to put a commercial in here, is Mark and Andre Viette were the ones that introduced me to it. And I have absolutely zero damage on a full acre of highly, you know, highly done yard here, and with many, many deer-friendly plants.
Wynn, thank you so much for
the hostas and the roses. No, not a mark on them.
For sharing that success story with us.
Yeah, but again, just anybody that tries it, the key is to get it extremely fine as to mist.
We got that point. Thank you so much. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Good luck, Wynn.
Hey, sounds good.
I know. The problem I've always associated with those spray products, and I wish Wynn the best of luck, is that the deer eventually seem to kind of figure them out. And they work for a little while, whether it's coyote urine or, you know, fish emulsion type sprays or Bob X, and they all smell awful. And heaven forbid one spills in your car, as it did to me several years ago on a hot summer day. But, you know, they usually do are effective for a while, and then they kind of things get figured out. But I hope it works. I hope Wynn continues to find success with it.
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with how hungry the deer are, what the deer pressure is, if they have enough to eat, or if they're really searching out for food.
And if your neighbor's food smells better.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Environmentalist and professional gardener Guinevere Higgins, as well as environmentalist and professional farmer Dave O'Neill, are here to answer your questions or listen to your success stories about anything related to gardening. And all of a sudden, all of our phone lines are open at 888-967-2825. We'll be back. You want to do the honors?
Sure.
So Anne, this is Facebook.
Oh, yeah. So Anne on Facebook has a great question. She says, I have lovely raspberry bushes that came with the house. I cut them back over the winter, but should I fertilize them? How often and with what?
That's great. What a benefit to the house. Raspberries.
Absolutely.
Raspberries are quite a treat. We had a great raspberry year last season on the farm. And our typical management with our raspberries is to cut them all the way back down to the ground once they go dormant in the fall or the winter. And then as they start to shoot canes up in the spring, we will apply 2 rounds of compost tea. And compost tea is an aerated, watery, aerobic mixture of compost that is brewed with water bubbles, basically, for 24 to 48 hours. And then we foliar spray that meaning on the leaves and all the different canes for the raspberries. And we do two rounds of that about 2 weeks apart, and we always get great raspberries. One thing to keep in mind with raspberries is they like consistent moisture. They don't like to get dried out, and they should do really well if you keep an eye on the moisture and give them some good compost.
Speaking of fruit, I'm sorry, did you have more about
raspberries? I was just going to say, and short of compost tea, if you can't get your hands on some aerobically brewed compost tea, compost will suffice. And now is a good time. Of course, things are so far ahead, like 2 weeks ago or a month ago probably would have been even better, but better late than never.
Back to the question we got earlier about tree fruit, plums, and peaches. Yeah, you had more you wanted to add for Stephen?
Oh, sure. I was just talking about beneficials, but there's also, that's kind of the first line of defense, but there's also playing a little more defense, which is...
So there are people who've joined in since the half hour ago when we first talked about Stephen. Beneficials, explain that and add in if you would.
Stephen was curious about growing organic fruit, which is the last frontier of organics. It's very difficult. There's a lot of different pests. One way to combat those pests is with beneficial insects. There's a whole host of good bugs that we can encourage in our garden, and the way to do that is to have lots in bloom in our perennial herbaceous layer. So lots of different aster family plants and mint family plants and umbel family plants. Umbel is anything in the carrot parsley family.
So that's the beneficials. Attracting
that attracts beneficials
that will feed on the bad critters.
Exactly, the ladybugs and the lacewings and all the beneficials. And then when we do get an outbreak of pests, we can use organically approved products like neem, which is basically a highly essential oiled shrub that grows in India. People use it as toothbrushes, but it's also very effective against pest insects.
Could you spell neem?
Neem is spelled N-E-E-M, neem. And
that's a spray.
And that's a spray. We can also, we use compost tea, which also helps the biological activity on the leaf surface. And then finally, we use Surround, which is a kaolin clay. And that is kind of an exclusion method. Basically, we coat the whole leaves and the fruit of the tree in kaolin clay, this Surround product. And it kind of hides the fruit from the pest. So that's a good organic strategy for growing organic fruit in this climate.
Next to Free Union, Jamie, thanks for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Guinevere Higgins and Dave O'Neill, please.
Yes, thank you. We have a pest, and I'm sure you're aware of the brown marmorated stink bug that showed its face in the last 2 years.
Sure.
And, oh my gosh, they are something else in our garden. They really take down our sunflowers, among other things. I didn't know if you had heard of anything that might be a deterrent as they emerge. I did hear that the Asian ladybug, which lives on aphids, the warm weather has brought them out early, but there's nothing at the salad bar for them, and I'm hoping that might be the case for the stink bugs as well. Have you heard of anything?
Oh, that is such a great question, Jamie. And if we had the answer, Dave and I would be off making millions somewhere.
The stink bugs are very problematic. And I think this season in particular, something to look out for is more intense pest pressure, because we didn't have a hard winter.
Yes.
Typically, we have less pest pressure when we have lots of hard freezes and the ground is frozen solid 1 foot down and it's a cold winter. It's great for gardening in a lot of ways. And when we have a warm winter, a lot of those overwintering pest cycles aren't broken. So we need to think like the pest. We need to think what the cycles are. And unfortunately, the stink bug seems to be very resilient.
Incredibly resilient, which is why we're becoming overrun right now. I mean, I've seen a lot of, don't have any personal experience with them, but I have seen a lot of signs at the nursery saying, you know, we have stink bug traps and we have stink bug sprays. And, you know, I think just be careful what you're spraying. Always know what you're spraying and don't be so determined to eliminate the stink bug that you maybe cause a larger problem by using a toxic. But other than that, I mean, good luck. I mean, I think that Surround product that Dave mentioned might be a good strategy on some of the fruiting plants, fruit trees, for example, and tomatoes I know have been have been pestered by stink bugs. So that might be effective. You know, other exclusion strategies, but man, they are pesky.
I'd like to see what chickens will do to a stink bug. I know.
I've heard but both things that either some people's chickens love them, some people's chickens hate them. So we'll see.
I have to back you on that one because I have a couple hundred chickens and they won't even look at the thing.
Oh, man.
And then my friend has chickens and they love them.
Yeah. Well, you need to get your friend's chickens over at your place.
Yeah. Breed chicken varieties that.
But
yes.
I'd like to mention one quickie on something you said earlier in the program as far as physical defense for your gardens, these black mesh, I guess you keep birds out of your garden with these fencing you can just kind of throw over. It's
mm-hmm.
nothing, but just be prepared. I tried that, and snakes get hung up on them like you would not
yes.
believe.
And sometimes, unfortunately, birds do as well. It's it's a very sad thing when that happens. Yeah, so building a better, you know, my mom actually recommended that you get like tutu fabric and use that to cover your fruit trees and you know, your blueberries and your strawberries and things that like to get eaten by birds, because it's just a little harder for them to penetrate and get hung up in.
Jamie, just one other thing about stink bugs. It's not going to help immediately, but maybe it'll give those of us who are worried about this hope. Several months ago, we had some of the Virginia scientists who are leading national research on how to deal with the problem. One of the things that they mentioned is that the U.S. Department of Agriculture is running experiments, I think, in New Jersey in a very small controlled environment where they are using the little tiny version of wasps from China that feed on stink bugs, this particular brown marmalade stink bug that originates from China. And this particular kind of wasp is its natural predator. Those wasps do not exist yet in nature in the U.S., but the USDA is experimenting with this to see whether or not releasing that kind of wasp, and I hesitate to call it a wasp because it's such a little tiny miniature creature, but that's what the scientists call it. If their experiment works, then maybe in a year or two we'll have better predators than chickens for stink bugs.
Right, or we might have a worse problem.
That's true.
I don't know. But, you know, the other thing that we don't care much for are these Allianthus trees, and they seem to go hand in hand. I think they have the same provenance.
Jamie, thank you so much for your call.
Thank
We're going
you.
To go next to Lexington. Marge has been hanging on for a while patiently. Marge, your question or comment for Dave O'Neill and or Guinevere Higgins, please.
Hello. Either one would be wonderful. My sister put in a wonderful vegetable garden, and of course she has a lot of deer where she lives out here in the county. And she did the 8-foot fence and all that stuff. No problem with deer. However, the moles and voles who get underneath and eat the carrots or whatever they're after, all the tubulars there. What in the world? She put chewing gum, bubble gum, someone told her. What can you do to eliminate moles and voles?
Chewing gum, bubble gum.
I've heard that one too.
Pre-chewed or after it's
chewed?
Well,
the idea is that the critters eat it, and then it sits in their stomach and does something terrible to them later on.
Yeah.
So, you know, not something nice to think about, but potentially effective. You know, I kind of hesitate to say this because... sounds like your sister has her fencing situation pretty well sorted out, but another strategy can be to dig down, you know, about a foot and put chicken wire or some other kind of very tightly woven fencing material, dig it down into the ground to help prevent exactly what you're talking about, the tunneling critters from getting up into your garden beds, because unfortunately, no amount of row cover is going to keep them out.
Is there smelly stuff they don't like?
Not that I know, but again, you know, cats and dogs can be effective as far as, you know, predators, thinking about introducing some predators into this garden ecosystem. And I know, again,
I'm sorry, well, what is a predator for a mole or a vole?
A dog or a cat would work well.
Yeah, she has a cat. Okay.
So that could help. Yeah, I mean, again, you know, oftentimes you see these products in the nursery that advertise that they're non-toxic, you know, and I think it's actually voles are the bigger problem. I always note voles are vegetarians, and I think moles actually eat like bugs. So they might not be a, you know, so much of a problem, except that they're, you know, laying tunnels all through your lawn. But
I just feel bad for her. She put so much money into this. I told her just go to the farmer's market instead. You know, it's just like she planted. She was so proud and all these things.
Yeah, shoot.
You pull up a carrot and there's nothing there.
Yeah. I mean, the other strategy could be thinking about things that they don't like to eat so much, because they really are root feeders, you know, so, you know, which is a shame if your sister wants to plant carrots. But, you know, there might be plants that the voles just aren't interested in.
Well, I will tell her. I'll tell her to put the cat in there every day.
There you go.
Marge, thanks so much.
Thanks for the call.
We got time for at least one more call, I think. Next is Swope. Is it Thea? Am I pronouncing
Thea.
Your name?
Yes, Thea. Hi.
So your question or comment, please, Thea.
Yes, I am starting a garden from scratch this year, and I wanted to do it as much as I can in organic. But I'm wondering, and it's on a site that hasn't been used as a garden for 15 years or so, and I'm getting ready to turn it over to till it. And I'm wondering if I should try to kill the weeds before I do that, or the grass. And if so, what with?
Well, your rototiller, or whatever you're going to till the garden with, will most likely do a pretty effective job of killing your existing species palette.
Okay.
So turning that in, letting that kind of feed the soil, letting it break down, maybe 2 weeks later, turn it in again. And you know, do your raised beds and your garden layout. That's what we do.
Okay.
On the farm, and then going right into either a cover crop or your vegetable rotation. So
okay. And that second till is a really great time to work in some compost. And I also recommend, you know, since it is spring, folks are thinking about getting gardens started. It's a great time to take a soil test. So that you have, you kind of know what you're working with, you know, your pH, your organic matter. That's really helpful.
Okay, great.
So you can take a soil test, you know, through Virginia Tech. I use a lab at UMass Amherst. You know, it's not hard and it's not expensive, and it's worth a lot of, it gives you a lot of information that you can use. And then always testing again in the fall to kind of see how you did. But that's a great way to improve your soil right away.
Awesome. Thanks. Appreciate that.
And we're going to have a slideshow at the Friendly City Food Co-op this Thursday, March 29th. So today is March 26th on Monday. And on Thursday, March 29th, we're going to have a slideshow at the Friendly City Food Co-op showing all kinds of great pictures from Radical Roots Community Farm, which might give you ideas for your backyard garden. So that might be something to check out as well.
And which co-op was that?
The Friendly City Food Co-op in downtown Harrisonburg.
In Harrisonburg, right.
And if your garden's up and running in a few weeks, I highly recommend getting your vegetable seedlings from Dave and his crew at Radical Roots. That's high-quality stuff.
Mm-hmm, thanks.
You also had an announcement that you wanted
to make. I do. If anyone in the Charlottesville area is looking for something fun to do tonight, tonight being Monday, March 26th, there is a fun gathering happening at the Albemarle County Office Building off of McIntyre Road. It's called the Central Virginia Food Heritage Gathering, and I understand it's going to be sort of a celebration of the foods that are sort of native and local to this region, seed swaps, food tastings, swapping tales, tall tales, maybe some gardening stories in there. So if that's something that interests you, tonight, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Albemarle County Office Building on McIntyre Road.
Let me mention, for the sake of Quentin, who called in earlier about the bees, and anybody else who might have a similar problem, on our Facebook page, we have a post that just came in from Ryan Williamson, who says he is a beekeeper in the Charlottesville area, and he would be happy to help Quentin out and probably anybody else who's not too far from Charlottesville. I'm not going to give his phone number out over the air, but he did list them in his Facebook post. And you can see that Facebook post if you look for us on the Facebook at WMRA's Virginia Insight. And you can read the post even if you don't have a Facebook account yourself. You just have to have the Facebook account yourself in order to be able to make a post. I hope I said that in a way that makes sense.
What a great connection for Ryan and Quentin.
That's awesome. Yeah. I know, the power of social media. And if anyone is interested, Ryan runs a wonderful small farm in Free Union, and he has mushroom workshops and does all kinds of cool stuff. So check out Ryan, even if you don't need a swarm removed from the property.
Also here on Facebook, This is Paula, who says, do you have any advice for eliminating poison oak or ivy from a yard?
Oh, gosh. Oh,
find someone who doesn't get it and employ them to pull it out for you.
What about renting goats? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I haven't really heard of any of those businesses in this area, but I know in other parts of the
busters.
World. Are they here?
In Afton, as far as I know, the goat busters are in Afton, and yeah, goats love poison ivy.
Yes.
Goat Busters is the name of an actual
business.
I believe
that's what it's
called.
That
rents out ghosts? Goats. yeah, right. Okay. One of those. Our guests have been Guinevere Higgins, professional gardening advisor and co-owner of the Charlottesville-based consulting firm Blue Ridge Backyard Harvest, as well as Dave O'Neill, organic farming specialist and co-owner of the Radical Roots Community Farm in Keezletown. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Juspe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Insight Archives. And if you go to that page, you can find links to more information about both of our guests. Plus, if you go to the Virginia Insight Facebook page and click like, you'll have access to a whole bunch more information about our broadcast there as well. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.